The Land of the Unsolved is sponsored by Spot Crime, the number one crime mapping site in the country. Make sure to visit spotcrime.com to track crime in your neighborhood, because safety begins with knowing.
Anyone who watches crime dramas could reasonably conclude that when someone is murdered, barring bizarre and extenuating circumstances, the case is solved. That is, through high-tech forensics, moral resolve, or simply the near-mythic competence of American law enforcement, killers are ultimately sent to jail. But as an investigative reporter who has worked in one of the most violent cities in the country for nearly 15 years, I can tell you, this is not true.
And that is the point of this podcast, because unsolved killings represent more than just statistics. It's a psychic toll of stories untold that infects an entire community. The final violent moments of a victim's life that remain shrouded in mystery.
I'm Stephen Janis.
I'm Taya Graham.
And we are investigative reporters who live in Baltimore City.
Welcome to the Land of the Unsolved. Welcome back to the Land of the Unsolved, the podcast that explores both the evidence and the politics of unsolved murders. Today, we're going to delve deeper into the mysterious death of Ray Rivera by taking a closer look at some physical evidence and clues about the case that has not yet been shared with the public. Today, we're going to speak with a medical illustrator who volunteered to depict Ray's injuries and, in doing so, revealed even more evidence that questions the idea that Ray jumped or was pushed off the Belvedere Hotel, where his body was found in a conference room in May of 2006. But before we get started, we have to make a short pitch to help support our reporting and this podcast. If you can, go to our anchor page and click the support button. Then you can make a small donation to support our work. And remember, every bit helps. Thank you. You can also help by purchasing one of the books Stephen and I wrote together about policing and unsolved cases. Why Do We Kill? The Pathology of Murder in Baltimore, You Can't Stop Murder, Truths About Policing in Baltimore and Beyond, and The Book of Cop, A Testament to Policing That Works. They're all available at Amazon.com if you're interested. Also, we'd like to take a moment to thank Whitney Klingensmith, a new supporter of the podcast. Thank you, Whitney. We appreciate you. Now, back to the case. As almost all of you know by now, the death of Ray Rivera continues to haunt not just us, but many of our listeners. In a way, his case reflects the harsh reality of the city where it occurred, a town where many murders remain unsolved, a lingering tale of violent death that hangs like a cloud over the city itself. Ray left his North Baltimore home in May of 2006 in a hurry. He grabbed his car keys, a credit card, and his cell phone and departed without even telling a house guest where he was going. And then he simply vanished. After a frantic week-long search, three employees of the firm for which Ray used to work spotted a hole in the roof of a second-floor conference room of the Belvedere Hotel in Baltimore's Mount Vernon neighborhood. Police soon discovered Ray's decomposed body beneath the hole. After a brief investigation, they concluded his death was a suicide, and as records indicate, simply stopped investigating the case. But Ray's family insisted from the start the water polo player was the last person in the world to commit suicide. The aspiring filmmaker was recently married to the love of his life, Allison. He had just finished a screenplay and was planning to move back to Los Angeles. He also started a production company. The bottom line, if he was planning to kill himself, nothing in his life that had preceded his death indicated it was even a remote possibility. Which is why the case was featured in the Netflix reboot of Unsolved Mysteries. The interest in Ray's death was overwhelming. People from around the world who saw the evidence felt the same passion for solving the case as we do. Some even reached out to us. Perhaps the most intriguing revelation since the show debuted was evidence neither Stephen nor investigative reporter Jane Miller, who did groundbreaking work on the case, had ever seen. The actual homicide files, which document the entire investigation into Ray's death, by the Baltimore City Police. The documents showed the scant amount of evidence and interviews conducted by the homicide detectives shortly after Ray's body was found. It also includes details of an inventory of items taken from Ray's car, which is found parked near the Belvedere, and some photographs that we will discuss in a future episode. But it's what's not in the case files that is most striking. It's what's missing. And to discuss it, I'm joined by my co-host, Stephen Janis. Stephen, what didn't you find?
Well, first thing, and I want to reemphasize this because it's important to understand for all of us what this case, what the homicide detectives did not do. There's no photographs, for example, of the scene where Ray's body was found. There is no diagram of the room where Ray's body was found. There are no subpoenas for cell phone records for Ray's cell phone, no records of cell phone records. And also, I spoke to a homicide investigator who said there were no statements taken from anybody. So even the three people who found the hole in the roof that used to work with Ray at Agora or at Stansbury Associates, there are no statements by police included in the file. It's standard procedure to take a statement. It doesn't mean that anyone is guilty. It's just to accumulate evidence. So many things. There was a person in the hotel, in the parking garage just adjacent to the hotel, who had been in touch with the police saying he thought they had video of the parking garage on the night that Ray disappeared. No follow-up with that person. Really, no follow-up with anybody at Agora or where Ray worked. And, no interviews with anybody who they might have perhaps traced through cell phone. So there's a tremendous amount of evidence and investigatory evidence that you think would have been looked at, which were not.
Stephen, that's a really interesting point that you just made, that there are actual standards that are used during a homicide investigation mm-hmm. that simply weren't met. Is that correct?
Yes. I mean, almost every homicide detective I talked to, and I talked to quite a few, said that there should have been a diagram, because a lot of people have asked me, a lot of people have called and or asked me, via internet, where was Ray's body exactly? I have a memory of it being, sort of on the northeast corner or northwest corner of the room, but there's no diagram for me to verify that. And even in the autopsy, there's no mention of where Ray's body, which would be significant. Very significant if you want to determine where he might have fallen from. Where the body landed, would any homicide detective would tell you, is the basic starting point for when you try to verify that someone might have jumped from a certain cliff or ledge or height or whatever. And that evidence is just striking that it's missing.
And that certainly would clue you in as mm-hmm. to whether or not Ray jumped or perhaps was positioned there.
Absolutely. That would give you, there's a thing called lividity, which is where blood pools, which can give you a sense of whether the body was moved. But he had been, his dead for probably 7 or 8 days. So there probably wouldn't be that. But, just looking at where his body was positioned would give you a sense of where he could have fallen from. It would be, I think, one very important clue to confirm the theory that he jumped from the Belvedere Hotel, which is why it's so troubling that it's entirely missing from the homicide file.
So what sort of conclusion do you draw from this?
Well, again, I want to emphasize this because Ray Rivera's case was not investigated. Somebody or something quite early on decided that it wasn't worth investigating this faulty theory of a suicide. But the bottom line that people have to remember, we're all shaking our heads about it because nothing was done. I mean, it was very preliminary work that anyone would do at the beginning of a homicide investigation. But these missing elements mean there has been no investigation, which is why we're doing what we're doing. We're doing the investigation, and that's what we're going to continue to do.
But it's not just what's missing from the files. There are intriguing aspects of Ray's injuries that have not been fully explored that raise important questions. Recently, we received a call from a person who has a special talent and offered to help. Someone with a special expertise who offered to help us answer some of the most vexing questions about Ray's death that are still unresolved. Her name is Marie Dauenheimer, and she's a medical illustrator, a person who literally creates a pictorial depiction of the victim's injuries. And she made an offer that astounded us. She contacted us and volunteered for free to help illustrate Ray's injuries. After she was finished, we spoke to her about what she thinks actually happened to Ray. Just a note, anyone who wants to view her work can go to our website, landoftheunsolved.com, or you can just visit our anchor homepage, which has a link to Marie's illustrations. Now, let's listen to the interview.
So, Marie, I'm just curious, what was it about Ray's case that interested you?
You know, I really felt awful for the family, for Allison and, Angel and the entire family. And it just really touched me. And it was just so baffling. You know, I went to graduate school in Baltimore. I'm familiar with the Belvedere. And I just found it so baffling that, you know, he could just disappear like that. And he was, you know, this tall, good-looking young man, and nobody saw him. And the thing that I found really frustrating about the Unsolved Mystery show, and I know they only had an hour to do, you know, include a lot of complex information, but I wanted more information specifically about the injuries. I was trying to read the autopsy report on the screen, and I just wanted to know more about, you know, what the injuries were. And then when Allison finally did get to see the medical examiner, and the medical examiner mentioned that the tibia and fibula fracture on the right side were inconsistent with that kind of fall that was being proposed. So, you know, from an anatomical and a mechanism of injury, that was really difficult for me to understand. You know, the first thing I would have thought they would have done was, you know, some kind of discussion of that mechanism of injury. So you've got these kind of injuries, what does that tell us? But then, you know, just everybody got stuck on the fact that he was found under this small hole in the roof. So I guess a lot of it was compassion for the family, and then my own curiosity as to, when you really look at those injuries visually and not just pages and pages of a typewritten report, but you really get a chance to, you know, look at an illustration or series of illustrations, and they really explain, you know, what the injuries were. And of course they were extremely extensive, very, very, very extensive, because I've worked on a lot of summary of injuries where people have been in catastrophic, you know, being run over by buses and falling off of scaffolding and stuff like that. But these injuries were really, really extensive. And then when you start to listen to Dr. Moya, it starts to all sort of gel and make sense. And, you know, it's been 14 years, and it's just, you know, it's just, I really feel like I wish the family could have an answer.
And just so people understand, what exactly does a medical illustrator do, and how is your work put to use?
Okay, so I'm a board certified medical illustrator. I've been doing medical illustrations for over 25 years, and I was trained at Johns Hopkins School of Medicine, and the program there, which is over 100 years old, really focuses on, you know, teaching artists. And I was, you know, I had a background in biological sciences and studio art, but taking that and sort of being able to have an understanding of biochemistry, molecular biology, pathology, pathophysiology, anatomy, embryology. And if you have that kind of background, you can then use those tools along with the artistic tools that you have to create scientific and medical visualizations that really explain complex processes. So one of the things that I often am called upon to do, and I have my own business, is to create medical illustrations for personal injury, wrongful death cases, where I can really sort of summarize what happened to somebody. And then a lot of times that'll be followed with sometimes mechanism of injury illustrations, and also, you know, surgical illustrations. You know, somebody's in some kind of an accident. You know, these are the injuries right after the accident. These are the subsequent surgeries they've had to have, and sort of give like an overview. You can sort of take this, you know, a pile of papers and records and MRIs and materials, and boil that down into a few comprehensive medical illustrations that can really show what happened. So the process with what I did with Ray Rivera's case was, you know, typically what I do in all cases, although in this case, unfortunately, I didn't have any actual images such as x-rays, for example, or MRIs or anything like that, or photographs. So what I did was I took the autopsy report, which you gave to me, and then I started to illustrate all of those injuries, everything from, you know, the the complex compound fracture to the tibia and the fibula, to the pelvic fractures, to the all the numerous facial and cranial fractures. And I started to just plot those out and measure them. I was also at the same time doing an illustration showing all of the external injuries. So I had the internal injury illustration, the external injury, and I was using the information from the autopsy report to help me really kind of plot and paint. So I'm essentially painting the injuries based on the report. There were points when it was difficult because the autopsy report would give precise measurements sometimes for certain abrasions or contusions, but then, you know, it was a little nebulous when they were describing, for example, the compound fracture to the tibia and the fibula and some of the pelvic fractures. I wasn't really told precisely where they were or how large they were. So there were some areas where, you know, I would like to have had a little bit more information. I don't know that that can really be clarified. I'm gonna hopefully get more information and opinion from Dr. Moya.
So what do you think about the idea that Ray fell through a hole from a height? What's your take on that theory?
Yeah, so I'm not an expert like Dr. Moya, although I've certainly worked on mechanism of injury illustrations with guidance, of course, usually from an expert, someone who's got the kind of background Dr. Moya has. I think I don't think it makes any sense that he went through that hole in the roof. The injuries just don't make sense. You know, I've worked on illustrations of people who have fallen off scaffolding on buildings, people who have fallen off scaffolding on bridges. You see a lot more bilateral lower limb injuries. You don't see that here. There's really nothing that happened to that left leg. Nothing happened to the pelvis on that side. It's really just very perplexing. Usually you'd see a lot more lower limb injuries, and again, they would be bilateral. So it definitely started to make more sense to me that he could have had some kind of, you know, either a car or something that came on the right side that would better explain those injuries, and specifically, you know, the injuries to the tibia and the fibula on the right side and to the pelvis. It's just this mystery. How did he end up in that conference room? You know, I know that you and Jane Miller have walked through the parking structure and were able to access that area. That area was being underutilized. So if somebody was privy to that, they knew that area was being underutilized. If they knew that, then, you know, certainly, you know, he wasn't found for, I think it was 8 days. He was, you know, serious decomposition. You lose a lot of evidence. And then whether that hole was purposely put in the roof to make everybody think he had to have come from that trajectory. So you look up, he came through, but the placement and the size of the hole, you know, has been suggested by numerous people that really doesn't make sense. But I think what's really tragic is that it wasn't investigated thoroughly as a homicide. And now it's 14 years later, and there's a lot of time that's passed, obviously. And, you know, the autopsy, I think they should have done. I mean, I've worked on a number of cases where I have worked from detailed autopsy reports. I've had photographs from the autopsy and as well as x-rays that were taken if there were extensive injuries that warrant that kind of, imaging.
So does that strike you as unusual that things like this would not have been included in the autopsy, like the x-rays or the photographs?
I haven't really worked that much with the Baltimore Medical Examiner's Office. It's been more Washington, D.C. and some other cities. And usually if there's pretty extensive injuries, I've seen x-rays and I've also seen photographs.
One thing that really struck me when I looked at the illustrations was his arms. I don't know if I interpreted it correctly, but it didn't seem like there were injury to his arms, which if he was falling is got to be unusual not to have any injuries on the hands. I would think you'd try to put your hands out or block your fall or something. It would be instinctual.
Yeah, because and just this whole idea that he went straight down vertical, that really doesn't make any sense to me. So yeah, I would have thought that you would see those kind of injuries. And I think also the head and neck injuries are not consistent. Dr. Moya mentioned that he had extensive head and neck injuries, but apparently, and I haven't worked on any cases where somebody's fallen from that kind of, whatever it was, 11 stories or 13 stories. But yeah, there were definitely injuries that weren't consistent with falling from that height. And especially when I look at it from my area of understanding or expertise is, you know, the lower limb injuries don't make any sense.
And what is it about the lower limb injuries that don't make sense to you?
Like what Dr. Moya said in terms of being unilateral, so it's only on the right side. And then I would have thought there would have been more injuries to the feet, because that's what I've seen when I've illustrated injuries where people were falling, like, for example, from scaffolding.
And just to reiterate, the hole was so narrow, he had to have fallen either feet first or head first, correct? I mean, there's only two ways this could have happened.
That hole is just, you know, that's, I think, you know, looking back, when I saw the show, the Netflix Unsolved Mysteries, it just was so bizarre. It was like, that doesn't make any sense at all. And you start to think about the physics of that. And I guess, you know, and again, not to beat up Unsolved Mysteries, but I would have liked to have heard from an engineer or a physicist, you know, specifically. I know that the detective had, you know, measurements in terms of, you know, going off the ledge, going off the roof, going off the parking garage. But I would have liked to have heard from somebody with the expertise of a physicist, an engineer, you know, and more medical professionals or forensics professionals that could have, you know, tried to explain those theories. I think what the investigators did, and I'm not trying to put blame, but I think they put the cart before the horse. I think they should have really looked at the injuries and then tried to understand the mechanism, as opposed to just, you know, take it at face value, this body, there's a hole, you know, he jumped. Because I think you can't just assume. And I think there was too much assuming going on. And I'm not a police detective. Maybe they had a lot of cases, they're overworked. You know, it just didn't make sense to them. They didn't have the manpower. But I think it's really unfortunate that happened. But in terms of the head and neck injuries, and I, you know, when I worked on, he had extensive head and neck injuries. What I think, going back to, again, what Dr. Moya and her her opinion and the way she analyzed this is, I think, it may have been more consistent with being beaten up, you know, in terms of, you know, head injuries that you see from somebody who's been beaten. And I haven't worked, quite frankly, I've worked on murder cases that have involved gunshot wounds and trajectories of gunshot wounds and such. But I would like to know, you know, if somebody could do a specific, analyze that material, you know, in terms of the injuries to the face and the cranium, because I think they're definitely seem more consistent with somebody who was maybe beaten with a blunt object. It doesn't make any sense that if he came through that hole feet first, that you would have this very dramatic compound fracture on the right side. So it's unilateral, it's just on the one side, the right tibia and fibula, but you don't see anything on the left side really at all. There's abrasions, lacerations, I think, but there's no fractures. So it just seems inconsistent. It seems odd.
It seems to me like us here on the podcast, you just have a lot of concerns and questions about the way this was investigated. And in fact, are saying to a certain extent that it wasn't investigated correctly at all. Do I get this right?
I just assumed when I watched the Netflix show that somebody must have gone in there, a photographer, you know, police photographer, that they would have, you know, done some kind of diagrams. I find it all very shocking that wasn't done. And then also with the autopsy that there wasn't more materials that were, you know, photographs, for example, any kind of x-rays, some kind of material to help really understand the injuries, the extent of the injuries, and what those injuries tell you about what happened. Because that's how most forensic investigations that I'm familiar with is, you know, the body's going to tell you a lot. And especially because so much evidence, and again, I'm not a forensic expert, but because of the fact that he had been there for 8 days, you know, there was evidence that was lost, but those bodily injuries really tell the story. They really do.
Stephen, I am struck by several points that are raised in this interview. First, that the injuries to Ray's body don't seem to line up with the hole and the theory that he jumped. And second, how much of the information she says was lacking from the autopsy?
Yeah, well, you know, when you look at the hole, the pictures that you can see online, the hole is very kind of small. It looks like something where he would either have to fall feet first or face first. And so, you know, when she talks about there not being any injuries on the arm and then only one leg that's really seriously injured, one compound fracture, it doesn't add up. The injuries do not line up to what you can see physically. The hole doesn't make any sense. It's strange enough to think that he would have fallen through the hole straight off a jump or a dive or being pushed or whatever. And then you have injuries that don't align with that hole. So it's really raises a lot more questions. But I think we're moving closer to the idea that Ray didn't jump or fall from anywhere.
So what do you think about the lack of injury to his hands and arms? Because I would think even if you were intentionally jumping, that you couldn't help it. It would be instinctual to put out your arms and hands in some way to break the fall. What were the injuries like on the arms and hands?
There were none. And that's really, really difficult. You know, the one thing that she said that was interesting is that, you know, that people who she has, you know, she has done medical illustrations of people who have fallen off scaffolding through injury, through accidents. And, you know, usually there are injuries to the arms and much more extensive injuries to, you know, the hands and things where you try to break yourself, as morbid as that is. And yeah, that is strange. I think when people look at the illustration, you know, you look at it, his arms and hands are pretty much unscathed, which I guess if he fell feet first might be explained, but, you know, we don't know he fell feet first. So, that's a really another difficult one, another adding up to the conclusion that this wasn't a fall.
The bottom line is this: we will continue to investigate this case and others. We will continue to look into the case files and search for evidence that will hopefully provide clues to solve this case. Remember, we can't do this work without your support. If you can, please go to our Anchor page and click on the support button. Then you can make a small donation to support our work. And remember, every little bit helps. You can also help by purchasing one of the books Stephen and I wrote together about policing and unsolved cases: Why Do We Kill? The Pathology of Murder in Baltimore, and You Can't Stop Murder: Truths About Policing in Baltimore and Beyond. They're all available at Amazon.com if you're interested. My name is Taya Graham.
And I'm Stephen Janis.
And I want to thank you for joining us for The Land of the Unsolved.